How would you approach that if you were going through a licensure and they said, hey, you know, sorry, you have this beautiful building, everything's great except this one thing. But you're like, yeah, but my architect said, here's the code. Like, how do you present that to them?
I think, you know, starting with, hey, this is the evidence that I have and the way I'm looking at it. And, you know, my architect's right here, and this is the way we're seeing it. Can you show me in code, NFPA, can you show me in the rule where it says that it has to be this? And this that we've done is out of compliance.
I have a better option than the dinky RAL. Let me show you how to create a luxury new construction mansion of an assisted living. When I started out in assisted living, nobody had a roadmap for how to build and operate a luxury assisted living. I'm here to document my journey as I grow my business and provide you tips and strategies for you to succeed. Welcome back to Assisted Living Investing with me, your host, Brett Schottkavis. We have a special show today. We have a couple people we are interviewing. John Darby is here with me in the studio from Torch. He's the executive director. And we are interviewing Michelle Dion Vaholic. She is the associate commissioner of long-term care regulatory, which really means she runs the show here for Texas Licensure. And so we're going to be asking her some questions today from the perspective of the providers. So, John, thank you for being on with me. Tell us a little bit about Torch. What is Torch and what are they here to do?
Well, Brett, I'm excited to be here today. It's a great topic and good fun to be had. So Torch, Texas Organization of Residential Care Homes. So we're a nonprofit association made up of owners of small many of them residential assisted living homes all across Texas. You know, by the name, we sound like we're small, which is true for most of us. However, what really ties us together is that we're all independent owners. You know, we don't have corporate counsel. We don't got a regulatory department that can then help us comply. And so Torch is out there to help facilities, particularly the small ones, with both their educational needs, compliance, as well as advocacy.
Fantastic. So Torch is an organization that I'm a part of. They helped me when I first got started. So if you're in Texas, reach out to Torch. They are a fantastic organization to help you with your licensure and your operations. But specifically, John has connections with the state, with the people who are running HHSC and the licensure board. So we're going to use that today to be able to interview Michelle, and really excited to have her on the show.
So I launched into this really long title, the Deputy Commissioner of Long-Term Care Regulatory. What does that mean? I mean, I once heard that the Health and Human Services Commission is the largest state agency of any kind in the country. So what's Deputy Commissioner mean?
So actually my title is Associate Commissioner. And so you kind of almost gave me a promotion there.
Nice. We'll give you a good word.
Basically, my universe is overseeing long-term care providers and the regulation of those providers. It includes assuring minimal compliance with Texas Administrative Code, other statutory requirements, complaint investigations, as well as all of the abuse and neglect that could occur with those providers. We also hold the authority to investigate the alleged perpetrator.
Sure. And so you talk about providers. So obviously assisted living, what else falls under that definition of provider?
Absolutely. So for long-term care regulation, this includes nursing facilities, prescribed pediatric extended care centers, day activity health services, intermediate care facilities for those with intellectual disability. This also includes our state supported living centers. Of course, assisted living. We also have home health, hospice, and we also provide the oversight and regulation for what we call home and community support. And that is our home and community-based programs for those with intellectual disability, the community providers. We also issue about 150,000 certifications, permits, licenses that would be deemed like occupational.
So that's meaning that you not only license facilities, but say in the nursing home world, that's a nursing home administrator or a medication aide or things like that. Is that?
Correct.
Well, let me ask on that point, you mentioned so many people in your organization, and then we came out of this, you know, post-COVID and inflation kind of salary adjustment type of area. How are you guys doing as a department with all of those metrics you guys mentioned?
Actually, in some areas we're doing well, in some areas we're not doing well at all. We went into COVID with a slight backlog in some areas to include, and specifically speaking of assisted living, not on point with routine resurveys or even complaint investigations. As we made our way through COVID, we came out of COVID with a tremendous backlog, unprecedented, to include an unprecedented backlog in assisted living. Overall, we don't have the resources. Those resources weren't there to begin with, devoted to licensed only work. So, you know, a very small team of surveyors that could focus specifically on assisted living type, you know, compliance. And basically with, I would say we're experiencing the same challenges that the industry is experiencing when it comes to staffing, recruiting, and retaining. So two challenges: we can't fill all of our positions. We often compete with the same industry as you do. You know, when it comes to hiring certain, you know, nurses, certain individuals with backgrounds, you know, they're just not, there's not a great supply. And there is so much of a demand that a lot of individuals can pick and choose where they'd like to work. The other thing is because we are short-staffed and we don't have enough resources, our surveyors are often put under a tremendous amount of stress and pressure. And so retaining those individuals becomes very, very difficult. We were fortunate enough, very fortunate enough, almost unprecedented, that our state legislature took interest in the regulatory long, especially the long-term care area, and did fund additional resources to provide us with some extra FTEs to be able to do this type of work, in addition to also funding a very generous recruitment and retention package. Both of those initiatives rolled out between September 1st of 2023 and October of 2023, and we have seen some impact. But again, the supply is limited when it comes to the individuals that, you know, and their background that we'd be seeking for to hire. The other thing that is challenging is not too many people really understand our work very well. It's kind of complicated. So we don't have the resources to recruit traditionally. You know, have we expanded into social media, job fairs? Absolutely, doing our best in those areas.
Do you see, in regards to, you mentioned staffing shortages, and we know we have a very big state, is there concentrated areas where there's shortages in certain regions based on density, or whether in a rural area, or how do you see that playing out to affect someone trying to get licensed?
Absolutely. Your metropolitan areas, your big areas such as Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, even Austin, we do have a lot of challenges in hiring surveyors because the demand for these types of professionals is huge. We're up against the industry demand. So actually, we struggle more in the metro areas than we do in your smaller areas. Some of our other challenges could be in remote parts of Texas, actually having someone in that area that is available for those providers. And so we may have to travel someone from another closer town, city to that location, meaning they're covering a lot of geographic area, which also can put strain and maybe us not be as timely as needed. I will add that one of our biggest challenges in recruitment is actually in the life safety code area. Mm-hmm. We are carrying the most vacancies in life safety code. Those are your architects, your engineers. When it comes to our safety officers, which assisted living often experiences, those could be fire marshals, even retired law enforcement, retired military, individuals with a unique background in general construction. We are really struggling all over the state. And I know as a provider type, you're probably feeling it if you've tried to go through the initial survey process, because providers are having to wait, and sometimes extended periods of times, because there's just not a life safety code readily available to get that life safety code survey done. And then, of course, you can't do the health until the life safety code part has been done.
And so just to help us understand the survey process. So on an initial, that's the only time you're guaranteed to have a life safety specific survey. On a renewal is eligible for a life safety survey. So you may get somebody with that architect background, that fire marshal background, but on a renewal, it just might be a generalist who is just as adept at, you know, looking through a care plan, say, as they are to go and test your fire system. Is there a way to prioritize that, or is it prioritized? Or when you have those life safety surveyors, it's just, hey, there's 2,000 ALFs, and here's how many are up for renewal, and here's a stack of news. Get to what you can.
Now, we do prioritize, and it's all based on health and safety, actually. So if, and to back up a little bit, in case providers, assisted living, are not aware, our life safety code surveyors do all of our residential provider types. So these are the same life safety code staff that are doing nursing facility, intermediate care facilities, state, you know, supported living centers, day activity health. They're doing a lot. So basically it's based on, you know, need, triage need. We do try to prioritize initials, but just to give you an example, in this exact moment, there are approximately 42 life safety code initials across the state needing to be done, and then 83 health surveys. And these are just initials for assisted living. If we add all provider types, we're close to 500 that are backed up in queue. Again, if life safety code manages to get out there and get it done, because we do try to prioritize initials, because again, we also look at supply and demand when it comes to providing care and services to a consumer. We understand the whole domino effect. If you've got a building waiting to go online, a home, and you've got a supply of consumers that are needing that home, and we're not able to get to you, guess who's actually being impacted? Not just the provider and the business side, which can be hurt. The actual individual who needs the care and services could be potentially, you know, waiting for those types of services. So they're impacted directly. We also look at supply of providers across the state. How, you know, is there a part of the state that's underserved and we need to get there first? I hate to say that, but some of those things are taken into consideration. But even if we're able to get to your life safety code survey, get that part knocked out, then you might have a wait for health, because those health surveyors are the same ones responding to priority one complaints, which are typically those that are health and safety, abuse and neglect. So if for some reason there is a surge of activity in a particular part of the state, and we have no resources, that health side of the survey could wait a little bit longer until someone becomes available, qualified to do it.
Sure. And appropriately so. Could you help us understand, you know, if you were to look at the entire workload of here's the total number of surveys in the queue, do you have a feel for what percentage of those are initials versus what are renewals versus what are complaint driven?
For assisted living specifically, we're probably 60, 70, 80 initials waiting in queue total to get them all processed and done. We probably have about 1,000 renewals that are backed up in queue that are late. And we have about 2,000 to 3,000 complaints that are backed up, meaning they should have already been done by now.
So regarding the initial, we know that the option to pay a fee to have the expedited for life safety. How does that play in from a logistics standpoint? If someone chooses to pay that fee, how does that get prioritized?
Actually, that would go to the top of the list because there is a there is an actual statute, a law that allows a provider to pay an additional fee to be expedited. That all gets taken into the consideration. It is possible for us still to miss the 14-day window due to other health and safety-driven life safety code activities. Believe it or not, there could be a health and safety activity attached to a survey of life safety code inspection, but they will go to the front and we will do our best to get there as close as we can to that 14-day requirement.
And so when that happens, right, so they come out, you meet the requirement, and the surveyor finds something that isn't up to code, they're going to, you know, go off and fix that and then call for resurvey. Do they continue to be expedited, or are they just, then they go in the queue?
No, we actually, when someone's been waiting and we get to them either expedited or not, that resurvey follow-up is usually done much faster because the focus of that follow-up is only going to be what was either out of compliance that did not allow the life safety code piece of the survey to be passed. In other words, you could have standard deficiencies that you need to fix, but something that would not allow the building to be inhabited, that's the focus of that follow-up. So typically we are much faster in getting to a home.
So something Brett and I have talked about, I'm curious if there's been any conversation about, on-site resolution or, you know, looking for ways for additional on-site resolution. Obviously a surveyor comes out and they're going to find some things that require retraining, require something to be done to the physical plant. And so there are some things that, you know, obviously are going to take some time, but it does seem that, you know, a lot of conversations we have with some of our peers is there's a citation, an appropriate citation that comes out that, you know, could have been slash was resolved, at the point of it being realized. But there is still the formal process of, okay, you're going to hear about this within 10 days. You have 10 days to respond. And I'm curious if, are there possible solutions to get things resolved at the point of survey?
Now, John, I can't say that it will eliminate the citation,
sure,
but if actual evidence exists, by the time we exit and the surveyor life safety code can lay eyes on it, collect that evidence, then it's possible that we could resolve the citation without having to go back. So you do raise a very good point and something that I think that is worth continued dialogue with survey operations and what would that look like? Because a citation could consist of this existed, it warranted the citation, it could have not passed the provider. However, this actually was 100% resolved before I left the site. Evidence showed this, and this, meaning it was 100% corrected. The citation still exists on the record because it did, but yeah. Your plan of correction is already there that suffices us not having to go back or hold up the next step in the process. That's a possibility for certain things.
Let me follow up a little bit deeper into that circumstance. If you as a provider are looking at your initial at life safety, and there are some things that are kind of just ambiguous, maybe subjective on some of these things, and your inspector says, hey, you know, this is not right, it doesn't meet, you know, certain type of code, but perhaps you have your architect or a fire engineer or some type of specific expert that says, oh no, here's what the code says, it is right, like they've told me this prior to. How would you approach that if you were going through a licensure and they said, hey, you know, sorry, you have this beautiful building, everything's great except this one thing? But you're like, yeah, but my architect said, here's the code. Like, how do you present that to them?
I think, you know, starting with, hey, this is the evidence that I have and the way I'm looking at it. And, you know, my architect's right here, and this is the way we're seeing it. Can you show me in code, NFPA, can you show me in the rule where it says that it has to be this, and this that we've done is out of compliance? Asking them to produce the actual law, any interpretive guidance around that law, is well within a provider's purview to do. And there shouldn't be any conflict over, you know, the goal is to get through the survey process and to, you know, to be able to have conversations, open dialogue when, you know, you're as a provider, you're genuinely not understanding, you know, it's coming. I really don't understand. I really need you to help me and show me, because you're going to leave and we're not going to still know what to do because we feel we understand. That would be my recommendation. And if I was a provider, that would be my first start in how to handle that. From there, if you're not able to move through that dialogue for whatever reason, I would highly recommend you begin using the leadership in the region before, if there's any way before that surveyor leaves, to reach out to their program manager. That surveyor should be and is maintaining dialogue, even life safety code, with their direct management throughout the survey process. You know, a surveyor rarely goes through an inspection without ever having a conversation with their manager. So starting with them, with their direct manager, to say, hey, I tried, we're still not seeing eye to eye. Can you help me? You know, it's more about, can you help me understand, show me, so that we have the information we need to be successful. Because right now, I don't know where it's at. I don't understand it. Your rule says this. We did exactly this. Your surveyor is quoting this. It's not aligning.
I think that's fantastic. How would you, as the provider, how would you even start? Like, how do you Google search this? How do you find out who to contact?
So one of the goals that I have is, you know, prior to COVID-19, most providers knew who their program managers were in the regional structure. They really did, because we were on target with having quarterly meetings, you know, liaisons, were making contact with providers and sharing. In other words, there was a relationship. There is a webpage that does articulate for the regional structure, you know, under Texas Health and Human Services, under long-term care regulation, that regional overview, meaning who program managers are. That's probably the best thing to do. And, or if a provider just doesn't know who it is, their actual program manager, I know that the regional director's names, phone numbers, and emails are on the website for all of the regions. Start there. Just email and say, I need to know who my program manager is, and I need to know who the assistant regional director is for me.
Well, Michelle, I greatly appreciate your time. As you were going through the list of everything you're responsible for, I was scratching my head, kind of shocked that she would have time to spend with Brett and I. Really, you know, I appreciate that. Brett, closing thoughts?
Well, I'm, again, just to add to that, yeah, thank you for jumping on with us. I think it's fantastic for providers, for potentially new providers, to hear this kind of message and know that they have people out there from the regulatory side that have really the same goal, right? We are on different sides of the coin, but we have the same goal to provide great care and to open up that dialogue between us and the managers who are going to help us get through this licensure. So thank you for jumping on with us and spending the time and educating us on some of these items.
Thanks, Michelle.
Most welcome. Thank you for the opportunity. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. See you.